So what we're going to do is we're going to look at this. Can you see it? Is it big enough, or do I have to make it bigger?
I can see it.
Let's see if I do this. I think if I do
Yeah, it's fine.
there, I don't know if I made it any bigger. Okay. So we on the night of Pesach we read the Haggadah. Okay, Haggadah. So why do we call it? It's called a Haggadah. Because it says in the Torah, "Higadeta lebincha b'yamahu le'mor," you're going to tell your child. You're going to tell higadeta, haggadah. It doesn't. Now there we also have this a word in Hebrew for what's called sipur, is to tell a story. Lahagid is to tell someone something, as opposed to dibor, vayidaber, he said. All right, so we're not saying. As much as it's a Haggadah, is lahagid, to tell. But in Hebrew, each word is very specific. So we're saying a specific word. So here God tells us that we have a mitzvah, we have a commandment that on the night of Passover, Pesach, we are supposed to tell the story to our children. And it uses the word specifically Haggadah. Okay, so the strange thing about the Haggadah, this is the oddity, is that if I'm going to tell the story of the night, what text should I use to tell the story? So without even thinking twice, I would go Exodus, right? I go to telling the story of the Exodus. So let's open up to Exodus and start reading through the passages that talk about the story as it happened, right? That's not what we do. The Haggadah, again, is coming from a completely different place. It's coming from Deuteronomy 26, and it's a completely different context. And the question is, why do the rabbis do it that way? Why did they set it up in this way? That they're going to use the source text of a completely, other place.
Class.
Okay, so the question is, what brings us here? Okay, so sometimes the easiest answer is the simplest thing, and that is that the rabbis are said, well, God said, he got it to. You are supposed to give over, and uses the word Haggadah, right? Higadeta lebincha. You're going to tell your child. Well, where else in the Torah do I have somewhere where it says this idea of using the word Haggadah? Okay, so it says when you enter the land of the Lord, that the Lord your God is giving as a heritage, and you possess it and settle in it. And you shall take some of a sum of every first fruit of the soil. Which you harvest from the land that the Lord your God is giving you, put it in a basket and go to the place where the Lord your God will choose to establish his name. Okay, and then you shall go to the priest in charge at the time and say to him, what does it say? Vi'amarta elav. Higadeti hayom la'Hashem Elokecha. I acknowledge this day before the Lord your God. That I have entered the land that the Lord swore to our fathers to assign us. Now, what does it say? Higadeti. Higadeti, which is translated here as I acknowledge. But Higadeti, Haggadah, right? Ha, hey, Gimel, Dalet, Higadeti is the word Haggadah. So now, just as I just noticed this as we're reading this also, one of the things that here, I just want to show you. Because everything is tied together. Nothing exists in a vacuum, okay? So it's very important to realize how all this stuff that happens is very exact. And so nothing's just happening here in a vacuum, but rather everything is very much tied to prior events. This context here. Context is very important. So the context of everything that we do on the Seder night and us as Jewish people really stems back to Genesis 15. Genesis 15 is like there are certain chapters that I always go to. Chapter 15 in Genesis, Bereishit, Tetvav, is about the Brit Ben Avatarim. That's when Avram and God, God. They have this covenant. It's a monumental covenant. And because God then says to Abraham, he says, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans, of a core custom, to assign this land to you as a possession, right? So that word, I'm giving it to you as a possession, is going back here. Now think about this. When you enter the land that the Lord your God is giving to you as a heritage, or as a right? It's here, as a nachla v'yirishta, and you will possess it. Again, this lashon, the language is v'yirishta, it's an inheritance. You're going to inherit, possess it, but it's the word v'yirishta. Again, going back to what God told Abraham. Lirishta, to possess. Again, so that word, so every time we see these things, the language is so exact and so important. Now, once you have that key, you can go and start, like, that's what when you look at the rabbinical text, the rabbis are always looking for these things to see how things connect. Everything is connect. It's all about connectivity and context as well. But you see that at the beginning of time, when God said to Abraham, he said, listen, I'm going to give you this land as an inheritance. And then what does Abraham say? How do I know? B'mayidaki roshana. How am I going to know? Okay, and God says to him, listen, Avram, Yadoa teda, you shall know for sure, right? That this is, but what's going to happen is you're going to have to go, your family, your offspring is going to have to go through 400 years of difficulty, of a journey, of enslavement and oppression, okay? So now here we are, we're on the night of the Seder, where we're telling over the story of this journey, of going through slavery and coming out. So now when I tell the story over, and it says, God tells us, now let's see if I can get this quickly. If I can find this quickly, then we're really in good shape. And that is, where do we see this idea of V'igadta l'bincha? I hope it's where I think it is. If it's not, then we're up the creek. I'll have to look harder, but here. So another very important chapter, there's chapter 3 in Exodus, and there's also chapter 12. Because chapter 12 is when God gives us the first mitzvah. Right, this is where God says to Moses and to Aaron, when the land of Egypt, this month shall mark for you the beginning of the months. It shall be the first of the months of the year, first commandment. And then he starts off, he says, the tenth day, you're going to do the Karban Pesach. You start out by taking the animal, and then it sits there tied to the bed. And for 4 days, it sits there until the time when it comes to do the sacrifice. So they do the sacrifice on the 14th. That becomes the Karban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb. They take the blood from there and they put it on the doorposts. And then you eat it roasted with matzah and maror. Okay, and then you can't eat it in any way but roasted. And then it describes this whole issue of the idea of how we eat the Karban Pesach, how we eat the Paschal Lamb. Then God goes out and he does the last of the 10 plagues, which is he afflicts or he kills the firstborn of the Egyptians. And God sees the blood that's on the doorposts and he passes over our homes. Now everybody asks, if it's God, like what does God need? Does our blood on the doors? And the answer is that we needed to do something. We needed to do some kind of active thing to show that we're in. And it's combined. And then God shows his mercy on us and he passes over our homes. And therefore we have a holiday of Pesach, Passover. Okay. So then it says 7 days you should eat matzos. You should eat matzah for 7 days. And the first day, you should make sure that there's no chametz in your house. And for 7 days, there's no chametz in the house. And then it's talking about the holiday of keeping the 7 days, not having matzah. And then this is all the commandments here in chapter 12. And then Moses calls and gives over the commandment and the whole doing. And then Okay, so here we see that what it says here, and when you come to, and when you enter the land that the Lord will give you, as he has promised, you shall observe this rite, which is again talking about this carbon, this sacrifice. And when your children ask you, what do you mean by this rite, lachem, you shall say, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, because he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians but saved our houses. The people then bowed and let bow low in homage. Okay, that was the reaction to that point. And then they went and they did exactly what they were commanded. And that's what happened. We have this idea that at that night, in midnight, God went out on the midnight of the 14th or 15th, really, and he killed all the firstborn of Egypt. And Pharaoh got up and ran to Moses and said, "Go out, go out, go out." And they took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading bowls wrapped in the cloaks upon their shoulders. So they end up going out. So here we see, so we don't have it here. So this what I was looking for is Vehigadta Labincha. So here it doesn't have it yet. Right now, the first mention is the question of your children will ask about the Korban Pesach, about the Paschal lamb. And then you tell them because of what happened here. So you see this progression. Now it's interesting, this is a very important idea. Verse 42, just remember this, is very, very powerful. That was for the Lord a night of vigil to bring them out of the land of Egypt. That same night is the Lord's, one of vigil for all of the children of Israel throughout the ages. This idea that the night of the Seder is like monumental is in this verse, chapter 12, verse 42. Leil Shimurim, there's this idea that on the night of Pesach, on that first night, we are like special, there's a special providence that we're protected. Basically, it's like, you can do whatever you want in a sense that you're completely protected. There's an incredible Shmirah, special protection for the Jewish people on this night. But what it also is really saying in this pasuk is that this is something that was from the time that God created the world, this night was meant to be from the beginning. That the whole purpose of creation is because God wanted the Jewish people to be his nation, his special nation. And it is that on this night that when we come out of Egypt, that we become his people. So this night is from the beginning. It's been waiting since the beginning of time. Okay? But still, we have to get back to the question of the idea of the Haggadah. Why do we read it from where we read it? So, okay, I'm looking for Vigad Telebincha. Ah, here we go. Thank you. Okay, here it is. It's in chapter 13, verse 8. Okay, because what's interesting is we actually, when we learned the piece on Tefillin, I don't know if you're anybody who was on that, where we learned that special one about tefillin, where the idea that when you put on tefillin, it's tying us back to the power of when we came out of Egypt. So we were reading through these. There are four paragraphs that are in your tefillin, right? There's a Shema and V'Hayam Shema, right? Those two, but we know we say all the time. And then there's the other two, which are coming here in chapter 13, which talk about coming out of Egypt, the idea of a focus on the idea of the taking of the firstborn animals and dedicating it to God. The same thing is if you have a firstborn male, you have to do a pidyon haben, right? You redeem that firstborn male. If he's not connected to be a Kohen or a Levi or some connection in that way, firstborn, naturally born a male from a couple, you have to do a pidyon haben. You redeem the child because really it belongs to God. So in these two chapters, which are also in our tefillin, it says in verse 8, it says, when you come to the land of Israel, and you're going to do this avoda, in this meaning, which referring to, again, bring the sacrifice of the Paschal lamb. And then you're also 7 days, you're going to eat matzah. And the seventh day is a special holiday as well. So the first day and the last day, and you can eat matzah all 7 days. You're not allowed to see chametz. Okay? And then here we go. And you shall explain to your son on that day, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I went free from Egypt. Which again is bringing us to this idea that it's personal to all Jews. It doesn't mean that you only, it's not limited to the person who came out of Egypt that year, but rather it's to us. And v'higana telebincha, but you are going to explain, you're going to give over. And again, it uses this word, v'higadata, haggadah. All right, so now we have this word, haggadah, 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 okay? So let's just keep everything straight here, okay? So the question first is, why do we, when it comes to the night of the Seder, use a text that's not in Exodus, A, to tell of this story, and B, also, we just jumped a little bit out to the context of the beginning of time, this idea of tying it to the land of Israel and the idea of inheritance of the land. And in the context of that, we have a mitzvah that says that when you come to the land of Israel and you have your first fruit, you're going to take that up to the Beis HaMikdash. And you're going to make a proclamation at that time. So here, and part of the mitzvah of Bikurim, of the first fruit, is bringing up to the Kohen. And you have to, at the same time, make this proclamation. It's part of the act of doing this. And it's called a Haggadah. Because it's V'amarte lav higadati hayom, Haggadah. I'm telling over, I'm acknowledging, but it's again, the same word is used. The only place in the Torah, besides for Exodus 13, of Haggadah, is here in Deuteronomy 26. Okay? So now the rabbis say, okay, if God told me what in Exodus 13, verse 8, that I have to tell over, V'gadta l'bin chabayomahu le'mor, I have to explain to my child on that day, saying, because of this, God took us out, took me out of Egypt. So now we fast forward to our Seder night. When we're now fulfilling this commandment, what am I going to do? I'm going to take the text from the place that it says in the Torah, Haggadah. And when is that? In the context of Bikurim. When I come to the land of Israel, and God is giving this to us, as he told Abraham, he would give us the land as an inheritance. And he's going, and then what? I do this mitzvah called Bikurim. I go to the Kohen, I give him my first fruit, and then I have to say this. You shall then recite as follows before the Lord your God. My father was a fugitive Aramean. He went down to Egypt with meager numbers and sojourned there. But there he became a great and very populous nation. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us, and they imposed heavy labor upon us. We cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our plea and saw our plight, our misery, and our oppression. The Lord freed us from Egypt by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm and awesome power, and by signs and portents. And he brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. So now, And wherefore, I now bring the first fruits. Now, this is where the Haggadah stops. The Haggadah does not include this. But until now, the Haggadah, this is exactly the text of the Haggadah. When we start telling a story, we tell it from Bikurim. We don't tell it from the Exodus narrative. We tell it from here in Deuteronomy 26. So now, why? So two things. One, simple, because it says, Haggadah, v'gadta l'bincha, you should tell your sons, Haggadah, and then it says in Deuteronomy 26, v'haggadah, higadati hayom, I'm going to say the same word. So the rabbis say it says it here, and it says it there, and this word Haggadah is unique. It's not something that's used in multiple places. It's only used in these places. So therefore, I put A and B, and I put them together. But more so, what's really underlying is that what you realize is that what are we doing here on the night of the Seder? It's a saying, we're really saying thank you. There's one, okay, it's multiple things happening, but one of the things is that we're saying thank you. So I want to know, how do I say thank you to God? Well, God said, first, I got to tell my kids, we got to tell, he got to tell the bincha, we got to tell the bincha, okay. But two, also, is that I need to proclaim and I need to review this whole process of the history. So in my ability to say thank you, God, for what I have, I need to go back in time and figure out, you know, or go through the steps of how I got here, and we see that the Torah itself is giving us the text. It gives us the text here in Deuteronomy 26. So the rabbis, they're not fancy guys. They're like, listen, the Torah is telling me this is how you do it. This is how we do it. Now, let's bring up a Gemara here. Let's bring up the Gemara. Let's see if I can open up a window here. This is being blocked. Let's do it under this one. Okay, so we're going to go to the Gemara in Pesachim. Because we call it intro to Talmud. So we got to do a little Gemara here. Okay, here we go. So the 10th chapter of the Talmud in Pesachim is where you really have the detail about the night of the Seder. Okay, so we last time we got together, we did it from here. We talked about We had done the beginning. I'm sorry. We started at the beginning of Pesachim last time, where we talked about the idea of checking for the chametz. Okay, so but when you go through this last chapter, chapter 10 of Pesachim, you find the base. It is. It tells us it gives us the blueprint for the Seder night. So I've got to pull up here. Sorry. So now let's find what we're looking for. I think it's here. Okay, no. Okay, give me a second here. All right, I'll tell you what we're trying to get to. So as I search, give me a second here, move this.
Hey, Jonathan, can I ask a question?
Sure, go.
So when did the actual Haggadah come to be created? Right, I mean, they actually made a separate book, you know. I mean, these are great references, and the original, I'm assuming that before the Haggadah was put together, that they somehow used this as a reference for what they did, but the actual Haggadah itself, when was that created?
So the final, like, you're asking, like, what was the Haggadah that we have today, when was it actually closed up? It's a good question. You could see from the Gemara, so the Gemara is coming from the time of the Mishnah, right? The Mishnah goes back even further, right? So it's, let's say, the turn of the common era. Okay, so going back that far, so 2,000 plus years ago, the formation of the Haggadah, as we see in the Gemara in Pesachim, is already referencing the Mishnah, going back to the time of the common era. So at the time of the, my guess is that they already had a form of Haggadah, based on the way we see this formulation going back to when the Jews came out of Egypt. Because you see in the Torah, let's say there might have been something. This Deuteronomy 26 is already coming more towards the latter part of the time that the Jews are in the desert, 40 years plus. You know, let's say that they were in the desert, that they're getting Deuteronomy 26, this idea of Bikurim and the text of the Bikurim. So, you know, the question would be, you know, over the course of the time that they're in the desert, what were they saying, right? This is always for example, to your question, like the idea of how we daven, right? The whole Shemona Esrei and how it's built, that's more of a, call it recent. It's not recent in the sense that it's definitely thousands of years old already, but the way that the Shemona Esrei was put together, that was coming also around this turn of the, let's say the 2,000 years ago. But it wasn't, but in terms of formal prayer, when they were in the temple, you didn't have the same type of format that we have. The Psalms existed already, right? They go back to the time of David. But the Shemona Esrei and the way that you have the, everything, how it's put together, that's pretty, that would probably come later with the Anshei Knesset Gadol, the people, the men of the Great Assembly. Right, so that's going to come a little bit later. The Haggadah itself really goes back very far. The way that the Mishnah and the Gemara here in Pesachim formulated, you see that they already have discussions that it sounds, you know, they already have the format. The idea of the four the four cups of wine, the idea of the way we eat the matzah, the maror, and the that how that is set up. That's going back to the time we came out of Egypt, and even the halal part, right? The latter part of the we have a halal at the Magid part, and we have a halal at the latter part of the Seder. That also, the Gemara is already going through that here in Pesachim. So you see that that's already set up. What's interesting is what I wanted to show you is that Rav and Shmuel, they disagree with, and they have a dispute as to how exactly do you tell over the story. Do you sell it from the vantage point of that we were slaves in Egypt, or do you go further back and you start talking about the fact that Abraham's father and family were idol worshippers? And that's, and if you see, you know, here, over here, this the fact that we the way we tell the story, or at least the way it's told in the text that we're pulling on, is that my father was a fugitive Aramean. That there's already, you know, he's taking us back. So that's referencing Yaakov, right? Jacob is who's the Arami Oved Avi? That's Lavan. Right, his father-in-law was trying to, you know, if we look at like who's the Arami Oved Avi, so Rashi tells us here, let's pull this over here. So a Syrian destroyed my father. He mentions the loving kindness of the omnipresent, saying a Syrian destroyed my father, which means love unwished to exterminate the whole nation when he pursued Jacob. Because he intended to do it with the omnipresent accounted it onto him as though he had actually done it. And therefore, aved, the expression aved, which refers to the past, is used. For as far as the nations of the world are concerned, the Holy One, blessed be He, accounts onto them intention as the actual deed. But we see this idea that it's referring to, that's referencing Lavan, right? So that's going back to Jacob and his father-in-law. But doesn't necessarily, it's not clear, does it go back to the idol worshiping thing? So then when you have this, so we have Rav and Shmuel, the dispute is to where do you start from? If you look at our Haggadah, guess what we do? Who do we do? Or do we go by the opinion of Rav, or do we go according to the opinion of Shmuel? Do we start from the slave thing, or do we go from the idol worship thing? Any idea? It's a trick question.
Idol worship.
What? You want to say, so Dave says idol, and Eric? We know that we definitely say the idea that we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, right? So the answer is that we have two, that both opinions are expressed in Haggadah. We actually start with the idea that we were slaves, and it also we have two versions of the Haggadah in one. They're both layered in. It references back to the idea that we were coming from idol worshippers all the way back in time, and at the same time it talks about the fact they were slaves. So really,
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So is the reference back to the idol worshippers demonstrating our imperfection at that time, that we had that little bit of, you know, in our DNA or in our, you know, our history? Is that the point of it?
Yeah. So we definitely it part of the idea is that when we tell a story, it's supposed to go back to we start the way the wording is. I'll tell you it says matchil beginut u'misayim b'shvach. We start with the negative, and then we end with the positive. Okay, so clearly we're showing that things weren't always so perfect as far as our beginnings, right? We had our issues, let's say, right? That so it's definitely referencing that aspect, right? So you have this certain type of we call it a chisaron, a certain lack. That okay, so I needed to look up the source here. So let me just show this you inside. Let me bring this up here. I'll get over here, 116.
Okay. Jonathan, I apologize. I'm going to have to leave at 10:30.
So no worries. Okay, here we are. Let me show you this. Let me get this back up. Okay, screen share. All right, so here. So the Mishnah, it says, the attendants poured the second cup. The first cup is Kiddush. Then we do, we wash our hands. We have the karpas. Then we break the middle matzah. And then we start the storytelling. At the beginning of the storytelling, we pour the second cup. And here, he says, the second cup is poured, and then the son asks his father the four questions, okay? Child asks the four questions. It's a little bit different in the time of the Mishnah. You have where they were eating the Karban Pesach. So there, it's already talking about the idea that they would have only roasted meat that night. Okay, fine. Then it goes on and says, and according to the intelligence and the ability of the son, his father teaches him about the Exodus. When teaching his son about the Exodus, he begins with the Jewish people's disgrace and concludes with their glory. So that, David, would go to your idea that we're starting with our disgrace, right? And he expounds from the passage of Aramean tried to destroy my father, Deuteronomy 26. The declaration one recites when presenting his first fruits at the temple, until he concludes explaining the entire section. So now, the question is, where does it start? How far back do you go? So here the Gemara, this is now, what we were reading was the Mishnah. Now within the Gemara, the Talmud itself, it says, it was taught in the Mishnah that the father begins his answer with disgrace and concludes with the glory. Matril b'genut v'misayim b'shvach. The Gemara asks, what is the meaning of this term, with disgrace? Rav said that one should begin by saying, at first our forefathers were idol worshippers, before concluding with the words of glory. And Shmuel said, the disgrace with which one should begin is his answer, we were slaves. Okay, so you have two opinions. And what do we say? At the end of the day,
We didn't choose to be slaves, though.
What was it?
We didn't choose to be slaves.
But we look at it as being in a place of degradation. Like we were, that was not where we want to be, right? So right? It's not.
But one seems active. If you're an idol worshiper, you're doing something intentionally. If you're a slave, I mean, like you're put in that position.
Okay, but either way, it's not the optimal. We don't want to be there, right? So that's the disgrace part of it. I mean, you're saying I wasn't my choice. Okay, it wasn't my choice. I mean, the crazy thing is that you see from Genesis 15 that this is already decreed from way at the beginning. What's interesting is this is a total parenthetical, but it's important. Is why did the Jews? What did we do to deserve going into slavery, or going into this prolonged exile that God is telling Abraham about, right? So like, where did that come from? So question, right? So the Ramban, Nachmanides, says it had to do with Abraham when he went down to Egypt himself and he told the Pharaoh and his people that Sarah was his sister and put her into a dangerous spot, that because of that, we end up having to go back to Egypt as well. And we suffer because of the fact that first, it's interesting, if you think about it, here God tells Abraham, I want you to go to the land, the promised land. And then what happens? There's a little bit of a difficulty. He's like, okay, I'm out of here. I'm going to Egypt. So that's Nachmanides. The Maharami Prague says, no way, cannot be. That's not what it was. He says, what it was is that when Abraham, in the context of Genesis 15, is that that whole conversation occurred right after Abraham had defeated the four kings. And everything that happened within that story is what's going on here. What do I mean by that? Meaning that whatever Abraham had been doing at the time, is what caused or led to the decree of the 400 years and slavery and etc. Question is, what was that? So there, the Talmud already has three opinions as to what Abraham had done wrong. Maybe either, so one was that he took these young students out to the battle. He should have left them studying and found other, you know, resources. Number two is that when he's having the conversation with God in Genesis 15, God says, Abraham, your children are going to inherit this land. And Abraham says to God, how am I going to know? Ba'amayda. And he says, whoop, that's a lack of trust in God, which is kind of crazy because before that, it says that Abraham believed in God and another promise that he gave him about having a child. But then the next line is, when God tells him, your children are going to inherit this land, Abraham asks, what do you mean? So that's also a potentially a certain flaw or lack of belief. And then the third is that when he won the war, the battle, the king of Sodom said to Abraham, we're yours. What did Abraham do? He said, I don't want anything, go. And he could have had the opportunity to bring them closer to God under the Kanfei Hashchina, it says, under the wings of God, and he didn't bring them closer, so he squandered a great opportunity to bring the most despicable people closer to God. So the Maharal says it's all three, and that's part of like what we're trying to do is that we're sent into this situation of Egypt to go and work through the issue of belief of emunah. What ends up, if you on the night of the Seder, as you go through it, you'll look and you're sensitized to this. You'll notice that both opinions, Rav's opinion of the idol worship aspect and Shmuel's opinion, that of being slaves, are both in the Haggadah. That they're actually two Haggadahs. When we tell the story, we're actually fulfilling both opinions. It's there. It's subtle. But it's in there. So what we have here is the construct of this of our Haggadah is we're basically doing the similar thing to bringing the first fruits and saying thank you to God. We're using that as our text to tell over the story so that the process of the story is to convey to our kids, obviously, this is who we are. We became as people based on the fact that we went through this slavery and worked through all these issues and came out, and God did this incredible thing for us, and therefore, we're here tonight to tell the story and to say thank you to God and to praise God. And it's a process of getting closer to God. This is what it is. It's about appreciating this special relationship. So here I'm going to tell you a very beautiful idea that I heard on Shabbos on Friday night. There was a special presenter, and he asked this question. One of the things that we do on the night of the Seder is we do recline. We recline. We're supposed to recline. As you see here, I'm reclining. So we were supposed to recline. When we drink the four kosa, the four cups of wine, we're supposed to actually lean to our left. Not to the right, but to the left. And if you have a couch and you have pillows, you know, that's the idea is that's a sign of freedom, of being a free and royal people. So as we recline, four cups, no question. When we eat the matzah, we're supposed to recline. But when we eat the maror, the bitter herbs, we do not. We sit straight. Because that, when you're having something bitter, that's not, you can't pretend that one. That is clearly not a time of salvation. That's still going back to the bitterness. So you don't recline there. So we eat matzah, recline, maror, straight. Then we have a third thing. What do? We take korech, which basically is we take matzah with maror and we make a sandwich. And the question then is, what do you do there? Do you recline or not recline? Well, there's matzah that requires reclining. But there's also maror that says no reclining. So what do you do? So the answer is we recline. Okay, that's the answer. So when you have that matzah sandwich with your maror, you recline. The question is, normally, when we have a doubt in halacha, and you're not sure whether you should do something or not, and it's a question, you usually say, you know what? You don't do anything. Sheva al tasa. I don't do anything. So why do we here, in the case of where we put maror and matzah together, do I go with the reclining? I should have said, no, I should just do nothing. So the answer is, what is matzah? So we read that matzah was the Jewish people had to run out of Egypt. There was no time because God said, time to go, guys. So we, because we believed in God and we had that special emunah, we had that belief, what do? We make matzah. So the matzah in itself, even though it represents multiple things, it represents the idea of being poor man's bread, but also is actually the idea of traveling, not waiting for it to rise, is an act of emunah. So that the idea of matzah is that of belief. Okay? So now, when I take the idea of belief and I put it together with the bitter, guess what happens? It changes it, the bitterness. It takes away the bitterness. Because why? So here's the beautiful analogy from the Divrei Chaim, the Sanz of the Rebbe. Zechusa Yagen Aleinu, his merit should be a protection for us. He says, you know, you're standing there and some guy comes running and smacks you on the back. And you're like, oh man, that killed. You turn around. Now, some people are like, I'm ready to kill the guy. I want to punch the guy, whoever it is, but I'm in a lot of pain. I turn around. It's my best friend from high school. I haven't seen him in 30 years. All of a sudden, the pain goes away. There's no pain, okay? So what do we see? That the pain is there. The bitterness is only there when there's no belief. The second that belief is entered, there's no pain. The pain it dissipates. That's what happens. When you take the matzah and you put it together with the bitterness goes away, because now I understand why I had to go through this. So the idea of that, the pain is no pain because it's been explained or etc. Right? The Muna gives us the idea to explain the difficulties. So that's one of the messages of the night, is that this is we're talking about a macro event of becoming a people, right? That's the Egyptian experience, the Exodus. But it's also for us, when we're sitting here in 2021, 5781, and we sit down on the Seder night and we relive going out of Egypt. So we have to go through it on the macro level again. And this is who we are. This is the Jewish people. But at the same time also, it's a time to develop the idea of belief that we are connected to God in the deepest way. So the truth is that when we sit down, at the end of this process, we're supposed to say Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, which is a love song between us and God, because the development of the night is supposed to become that of understanding that we have a special relationship. And then when we understand and we recognize that special connection, relationship that we have with Hashem, so then even the difficulties that we go through, the Korach, the Marah, let's call it the Marah, right, which is, this is like obviously here. This is what it means to be alive. To live life is to go through difficulties. It's just what it is. So that, but if we put in the matzah part, we wrap it together with the belief and understanding that everything that God does is for the best. So then, it changes the whole story and our experience. So the walk away or the takeaway from the night is to be, it's supposed to really be exciting and heartwarming and developing our, helping us develop that stronger connection to God. And so that's, you know, that what's emblematic in this special matzah sandwich that we make. We're taking the bitter stuff, wrap with emunah, and we recline, because That's how it goes. When we really put it all together, it comes out to be this beautiful and very special thing.
That's really cool. That's a really interesting.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, so a new idea, right? Yeah. So going to put it all together. So when we the way that the Haggadah is put together, it's very much based on that of appreciating the Thanksgiving aspect of the fact that we're telling it from the aspect of Bikurim. Also the fact that it is tying us, the whole Bikurim is bringing us back to the idea that when we come to the land of Israel, And we inherit and we possess and settle it. And we're able to then bring this this thanksgiving to God. And then we have to tell over. So one of the things going back also to Genesis 15, if you look at this, you know, this conversation, even though there's obviously, we said the morale is saying that there was some kind of issue there when Abraham and Avram asked the question of God, Bama'ida, how will I know that my kids will inherit? But the other thing is the word of Yadoa or Yadi'ah is to know. You know, the word, like they'd say to be know someone biblically is like, you know, the idea of a sexual connection. But Yadi'ah is to know something. So the nature of the, of again, going back to the beginning of time for us as a people is really with Abraham, is God says to Abraham, know well that your offspring shall be strangers in a land not theirs, and they shall be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But this idea of Yadoa Teda, he asked the question, how will I know? Bama Eda, how will I know? And God says, you will know, they will know. Yadoa Teda, it's a double, it's like, he could have just said, Yadoa, they'll know. Yadoa Teda, the double usage of knowing, is like, it's an emphasis to know. Because part of what we, as Jewish people, we're always, and that's part of the questioning, to know something. Also, the idea of zachira, zachor, is also part of the driver of the night, is to remember. But to remember something is to also differentiate. That's why we're asking questions. The whole questioning thing, why do Jews ask questions? We're always asking questions, is because God is saying to Abraham, you're going to know for sure. Part of the process is developing the ability to understand. And Zechira is to make, why do we make Havdalah on Friday night? I mean, on Motzei Shabbos, on Saturday night. Havdalah is to differentiate. The idea of Havdalah is coming from the fact that God says to remember. Remembering is to be able to differentiate and to make distinctions. And so part of the night also is a night of distinctions. We're differentiating and making a distinction between these certain things. And therefore, we start to ask questions. What's interesting in the Gemara asks, like, what's this whole Manishtana thing? One of the craziest things is we start dipping things. We don't dip usually. Like, everyone dipping in the salt water, right? We're dipping, then we dip the maror into the charosa. Like, we're doing all this dipping stuff. And they ask, so why do we do that? And the question, the answer is so that the kids will ask. So when the kid asks, so why are we dipping? Oh, good, because I wanted you to ask. Like, it's like, it's a circle. Like, what do you mean? I don't understand. So the Tosus there, the Gemara, says that the point is not that, is you want to create a situation of where they're questioning. I want questions. You think that questioning is bad. Judaism says, no, I want to question. I want you to be questioning. The questioning is a good thing. And it's, and there's no, and it doesn't mean that there's any quick answer. If anything, one of the things, this is actually wild, is that when Moses goes to Pharaoh for the first time and things get worse for the Jewish people, it comes back to God and he complains, like, God, I don't understand. You told me, you sent me, and I thought everything's going to get better. It got worse. And God says, listen, Moses, now you will know. And they say there, it's because of that questioning that God says to Moses, you are not going to see the final redemption. You're not going to get into the land of Israel. At that point, right there. Why? Because he was looking for the quick answer. Now you'll see the salvation. You will not see the future because you're looking for something quick. The nature of the Jewish people and our journey is it's not going to be a quick answer. But the questions are the most important thing. Is that we need to always be searching and continue to search. So whatever might have been understood in the past is continuing. So 2021, we're going to sit down at the Seder night, and we're supposed to ask questions, and we continue to push. And I want to, and we're all like, no, there's no quick answer per se. There's a lot of answers. But the questioning should continue because it's going to help us look for more stuff to find, because God's saying there is no, it's not small. This is not a small thing. It's a bigger type of thing that we're questing constantly to find the ultimate answer, which we don't necessarily have. We have a lot of answers. We have a path, but we're still on that path. So it's not, there's no like, you know, so the key of the night is the questioning. It's the manishtana, okay? So that's, it all stems from this knowing. How do you know anything? You only know things because we quest to understand. So more important is the question sometimes than the actual answer, even though it's important to get some answers also. But this idea, it's all predicated on this. When Abraham asked, how will I know? And God says, you'll know through this journey. But it's part of the journey is the continuous questioning. And that's why the night of the Seder, it's the four questions which are put out there, but it's really a format. And so the night of the Seder also is this incredible night for us to sit together with our kids and with our family members and to ask these questions and to delve and to really, like, you know, let's try to understand. Let's try to get better understanding, because that's what God was telling Abraham, is it's all about getting to know and to understand and to really delve in and to be on a path of that, of the questioning, and to continue on that, to seek, to be seekers. Because one of the things that Abraham was a seeker. He wasn't satisfied. The reason he got to where he was is because he grew up in a place where they were worshiping idols and they had a system that seemed to make sense and work for people. And he's like, this doesn't work. I'm looking at this thing called the world and creation. I'm like, this doesn't work. And therefore, it put him on the outside of humanity at that time. But it's his searching that helped us find Hashem and understand there was a unity in the world, etc. And then it put us on this pathway. We have something else that Abraham didn't have. We had a Torah. We were able to see God in this more overt way through the Exodus and through the Sinai experience, etc. So we have more to work with, thank God. We're lucky in that sense. But the questing is still very important. And so that's the context of the night as well. We're here to say thank you. We use a text that is a thanks-based text. And we're asking questions. And we're telling over the story from the negative to the positive. But it's to continuously be on this quest to get better understanding. Because one thing I could tell you, if the point of the night is to become closer to God and to have faith and emunah, belief, well, God is so big and so endless. So we can never be satisfied with whatever understanding we have. We always, at whatever age we're at, we're constantly required to quest to get a better understanding. Because we'll never actually get to the end point. But every time we gain more and more understanding, what it does is it brings us closer and loves. And the more we know, let's say, for example, our spouses, the more we get to know our spouses, the more we love them. The more that we get to know and spend time with our kids and get to see their great aspects, we love them that much more. So too with God and our relationship with Hashem and his world is the more we understand, like the Rambam Maimonides tells us, the more we understand, that much greater is our love for Hashem. And the more we understand, wow, he's so big, he's so endless. And whatever I thought I understood yesterday is nothing compared to what I understand today. And God willing, I'll know that much more than tomorrow and et cetera, et cetera. And my the goal is to be like a young child who's constantly curious. Wow, I just learned something that much greater. That's the quest. The quest is the idea. Yadoa te das, to know, to continue to know, and to know more and more. And once we're on that pathway, and we accept the fact that this is a journey, because that's ultimately what God was telling Abraham, this is a journey. So then the night of the Seder becomes like an act of continuing that and sharing it with our loved ones at the Seder.
I should only hope that my family thinks about and asks questions.
Well, that's the idea. So you have the four kids, right? You have some that don't even know that they can, they don't even know how to ask, you know? So the point is,
I also feel that sometimes the seemingly routineness of the Seder itself among the people who maybe are not continually, you know, learning and reading like us, they get caught up in the fact that they know the story. And so maybe they're not questioning as much because they feel it's this very basic, very simple story that they learned from the time they were young.
Right.
And I know that we're older now, so we should look at it with a newer lens. I'm just saying.
So the question is, how? That's the challenge. The challenge is, so how do you make it relevant? And you have to think about how to create the relevance of today's day and age to figure out, like, for example, I'll tell you an exercise. So today, our biggest challenge, or one of our biggest challenges, is the fact that we're told how to think. So in a sense, we don't really have an open mind, or we only think, it's like the PC culture is saying you have to think a certain way. So in many ways, is that a good thing or bad thing? Well, let's talk about that. The fact that you're classified as this or a that, and therefore I could tell you exactly how you think, that's insanity, right? But that's the world we live in. So today in 2021, when we sit at the Seder and we're talking about freedom and about liberty and freedom, we're not really free and we're not really liberty anymore, right? So that's today's talking about, bringing this, what we call about the night of the Seder, and bringing it to 2021, and let's talk about it. So all these issues, it's something that's saying, okay, God took us out of Egypt. All freedom, movements for freedom are built on the night of the Seder. The idea of the Exodus from Egypt, it is the playbook for all future movements for freedom and salvation.
Obviously we tie in like the, one of the things I try to do is have a conversation about, there's a lot of things that enslave us that are not pharaohs, right? I mean, think about it, our cell phones. I mean, a perfectly great example, seemingly awesome, but at the same time, especially younger people, you can't be away from it. It's an addiction.
Correct.
And there's other things in your life, and food and other addictions. So there's some things, conceptually I can bring up, but what I'm saying is...
But also, the other thing is, I would say, for getting away from the story per se, and let's say bringing it towards like more God discussion, what's crazy about Judaism today is that because Christianity, talks about God, 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 and JC and all that stuff, Judaism kind of went away from that. They were, as a reaction, we're not necessarily as comfortable to talk about that as much. This is a religion, but that's something that at the night of the Seder, we're supposed to talk about. God said, I took you to be my nation. I want to have a relationship with you, right? So here's God. That's the Egyptian. That's part of the Passover story. I passed over because I love you. Now, what the heck, what does that mean? So maybe talk about that. Maybe let's talk about God. What does God mean to you? And that most people, they would be like, I don't know. Well, let's talk about that, because if that's what God is doing here, he's really got a lover. He calls Avram his lover. Avram Ohavi, he's my lover. Like, what does that mean? Well, I know what it means, but do we talk about it like that? Do we really appreciate that? So we need to, that's something that we should talk to our family about. What does that mean? What is it? I don't even know what it means to me. I need to work that through also. Let's talk about that, So these are very important. This is a work. This is a ma'avod hazod. What is this work that you're doing? So we're working there. We're supposed to put in some effort. I mean, listen, the wine's good. And there's a lot of good wine out there. Matzah, depends. But, I happen to enjoy matzah. I don't know, it's the after effects, but it's, but either way. But the point is that these are all props. What's the ultimate is, where is my heart and mind? And so we need to pull ourselves, and then by pulling ourselves, pulling our loved ones in to discuss, hopefully having a real meaningful conversation about these things,
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry, I have to leave.
Nope, no problem.
Former CEO Mark Rumberg lost his mom last week. Depends. And she actually, it's really interesting because she was a Holocaust survivor, and about 6 years ago or 7 years ago, she decided, told the family she wanted to go back to Warsaw, where she grew up. and she's been living in Warsaw. She's, I don't know what her age is. She was in her 90s.
She was living in Warsaw. Wow.
She's been living in Warsaw, and she passed away in Warsaw. And then they had their, it's taken them time to get the body back, and then they had the funeral on Friday. But yeah, it was really, I mean, his, the graveside, Levaya, I don't know if that's what it's called, but was really, really powerful, because Mark's a great speaker anyway, and then his family, but because of his history and the whole, this whole dynamic of, she wanted to grow, she wanted to live where she lived, and she felt that, yeah, and very interesting. So,
wow,
awesome seeing you. Thanks so much, Jonathan. Love you guys.
Okay, have a good one. All the best.
Bye,
All right. Yeah, that's pretty, that's interesting. I haven't heard that one. It's a new, all right. Any other questions?
You know, what kind of like resonates for me is the discussion of asking the questions, and that it's okay to ask the questions, because ultimately Torah stands completely on its own. We may not understand everything that we're asking. Like, you know how some of the commandments, there's really no answer because God said so. But there's a meaning somewhere.
Right.
We just don't understand it, maybe in our physical realm.
Right.
You know?
Right. But you have to, yeah.
But what's interesting is that, you know, certain things, you're not allowed to ask questions. You know, in Christianity, it's not about asking questions. During the last year, with all the political upheaval that was going on and the cancel culture, somebody actually said to me, it's for the greater good. Like, don't ask. It's for the greater good. And if it's for the greater good, why can't you ask the questions? It should stand on its own.
Right.
You know? And that's really like the beauty of everything we do. We might not understand everything. It's there. If you keep digging, we might get it. But it's based on truth as opposed to something that's false.
I would go, let me put it this way. I would go as far as say like this. There are certain strands of within Judaism today, in observant circles as well, that they're afraid to ask the questions, which is, I think, Christianity's impact on Judaism. Because Judaism is not afraid. True Torah Judaism should not be afraid to ask the most crazy, the most difficult questions. You need to question. It's when you see a Torah observance, quote unquote, that doesn't, there's a problem there. That's not authentic. Okay? I'll go on the record. That's not authentic. It's a very when we understand our roots, going back to Abraham and going straight through, we're not afraid. And you see the way the Torah is critical. The fact that you can have Torah saying, what did Avram do wrong? And not be, you know, that's, we, and even in the Torah itself, like you see, like he's criticized for certain things and multiple, all, you know, go through the personalities. Moses is punished and this one's punished. We're not afraid to be critical. You know, this is that we have to be brutally honest, and in that way we can get to better places. But if we're afraid to ask, and that's probably one of the big things today, is that as a society, we're afraid to say, you know, it's like I found the book where this guy went around the United States asking questions. He posed as a German reporter, and he was just going around the United States, and he'd ask people about their positions, and a lot of times people are afraid to tell him the truth. And he said, "What, this is the land of the free and the home of the brave? Like, you know, where's the freedom if you can't express your true opinions?" So, and then when you go there, like all of a sudden you're afraid to think certain things. We have to, like, you know, we're not, we have to, that's part of the Egyptian experience of the Exodus, is becoming free. Freedom means to be able to think freely and to, you know, speak freely. So that's something that even in Judaism itself has been impacted. There are certain places or groups that are afraid to ask those questions. We need to ask. We need to be seekers of truth, which is sometimes we're all, you know, that's part of where we have to push. Yeah.
There was a lot about having a Gentile person at a seder table.
Is it a problem?
Is there a rule that you shouldn't have a Gentile person at your seder table?
I think that it's
is that an actual law, or it's just like tradition, you know?
I think it's just kind of a, it makes, if you're really thinking about talking about the Jewish people, on that night. So yeah, it's a little bit uncomfortable if you're really putting it out there. If it's for them to be able to appreciate, you know, the idea of the Exodus story and the freedom, etc. Again, everybody's got, you know, I you have these situations, so it is what it is. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. I face this on a weekly basis. One of my youngest son was going out with a Gentile girl, and mm-hmm. he broke up.
Okay.
Okay. Mazel tov, right? My oldest is going out with a Gentile girl, and she's, you know, they're very strict on COVID, and she, you know, lives in Queens, and she comes every night, every Friday for Shabbos dinner with us. And whatever I do, I talk about our Judaism, its beauty, but in a way where we're different. Like, you know, not in a bad way, but like subtly, it's a message. We're different people. We're it's not something you could just. Someone said something interesting about, like, you know, my son says he's going to break up with her. I hope you know, maybe it's part of the COVID, just getting finished with COVID, and you know, it's not easy, you know, to do it right the second. But I think he's getting there. But
how old is he?
He's 25.
He's 25. Okay.
25, 26.
I got a nice Jewish girl for him.
You know, he has to break up with this girl. I got a lot of Jewish girls. So the point I'm raising is that, you know, he's, a while back he said something about converts. You know, whoever I marry, if they're not Jewish, they'll convert. And conversion, I learned something very interesting. It's not a choice. I'm going to convert so I can marry this man. You know what I'm saying? If someone's going to convert, it's not a choice. It's something I have to do this, whether without this person or not. There's something in me that I can't live any other way.
Right.
And that's a real stretch for someone to really, you know, to see it that way.
Right. Well, you know, it's you have to be, you're doing it because you feel that pull. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I just read a very interesting article about, that someone wrote about this because of this issue of conversion in general. Came up in Israel with the Supreme Court decision there. But what does it mean when you want to convert to Judaism? You're doing two things. You want to become part of the Jewish people and at the same time also take on like the Torah and things of that nature. So like, but the first thing is not such a, you really have to be, you know, there are people that feel like like there's someone that I know that converted who she said, like from the time that she was a little girl, she felt this pull towards being Jewish, you know? So that's, right. Like you're saying, it's got to be something that's something personal that's within you, yeah.
Right, like it's not a choice. It just has to be, you know, like, yeah. Which, you know, anyway. So, but I feel as if, you know, that approach is a good thing, but it's got to be very subtle, you know, hopefully, you know, we're getting there.
Tricky, very tricky. Tricky time.
But you want to know something?
Yeah.
I came to the conclusion that, and this is hard because it breaks my heart, but if my kids don't get married outside, I can only do what I can do. Hashem put me in this world. I was born to my parents. I was living in a certain way. He knows exactly everything. He knows that some people are going to go and some people aren't. Right. You know, we can only do what we can do, you know, put in the effort
right.
to try.
I would say like this, very important, and this goes for every parent, that you have to love your child and you have to give them, first of all, there are two things. One, you have to love your children unconditionally with, obviously, you know, not to let them do whatever they want, but to give them that real sincere love, not to try to control them. To try to educate them and to show them your passion for your, you know, you have a passion for your Judaism, and the way we live our lives is the most important educational tool, right? I mean, you have to walk the walk and talk the talk if you want, right? Which, you know, so, right, so you're doing. And then you just got to continue to have, you know, that relationship. Because if you don't have a relationship, you know, what are you going to do? But if you have the relationship and you're doing your thing, I think there's a very good chance that it's going to make an impact. And if it doesn't, if the kid still is independent, you raise them to be their own person, they'll make their choices. You know, that's ultimately It's up to them to figure it out.
You know, I once heard a share from Rob Gobb, and he talks about locked in decisions. I don't know if you've ever heard that one that he does. You know, when you get a tattoo, it's a locked in decision. You're stuck with it. When you have a child, it's a locked in decision. When you get married, it's a locked in decision. When you put it like that, you know, this is something that will affect you the rest of your life. You know, just don't cavalierly decide you're going to get married.
Right.
A locked in decision. Just think it through before you do it.
Right.
I think that's powerful enough. You know, but you know, when you think about it, anyway.
Yeah.
So.
I'll tell the other thing that another friend that when he's going through this, and he said he davens a lot, and next thing you know, his daughter, who was dating a non-Jewish guy, they broke up. He's like, this stuff works.
It does work. You know, it does. I was talking to a friend of Simba Barnett. You know Steve Sokol? Frank, you know him? Do you know Steve Sokol?
Yeah.
He's a friend of Simcha Barnett,
okay.
Tall guy, secular guy, grew up together. His son was going with this non-Jewish girl and from Mexico, talking about, you know, marriage, talking about conversion, all this stuff. He ends up breaking up with her. His daughter, goes to this mayor, you know,
Mayor.
Some sort of organization his daughter goes to, and she meets his son. You know, he meets somebody, a girl, and says, "You know what? You'd be great with my brother." And he's off the radar. You know, the one who just broke up with the Mexican girl. You know, all of a sudden they put them together. She's an Orthodox girl now. Okay,
mm-hmm.
that he's introducing the brother to that was going to marry you know, this Mexican. And sure enough, you know, like he breaks up. This girl goes to this party. Boom, she meets this girl. You got to meet my brother. Da, 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 da. All of a sudden, they start talking, whatever, you know, and it goes on a progression of from a perspective. It doesn't go, you know, from and he has a background. Sure enough, he marries her.
Wow.
And the daughter, his sister had to be at that moment. At that party, to just be in front of that person, to do this—it's wild.
Yeah.
But he had to be ready.
That's awesome. That's it.
Had to be ready.
Yeah.
So, anyways, have a wonderful Pesach.
Me too.
And you know, last year was a very interesting Pesach. It was like we were in such darkness, right?
Right.
And you know, like somebody once, an Orthodox person thought Mashiach was coming. That's, you know, like the darkness was so intense.
Right.
But, you know, maybe if, you know, listen, maybe if we can get more people to participate in the Seder, it would be just enough, you know, like, you know, who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Listen, to keep on doing, and you never know. That's the point. I don't think that the issue with getting into this whole Mashiach is here type of thing, I could say what I see. What I see is that a very large majority of the Jew, or most of the majority of Jewish people, like meaning are living in Israel, that there's a country that's developing, that's a Jewish state, that's in the place that we're talking about Hashem promised to Avram. That's a good sign. Things are going in the right direction, right? But we have it's not over. We're on a path. So
no, there's more work to do.
Correct. And we're doing, it's good. It's happening. It's happening.
But the peace that's coming with the Arabs, like, you know, like,
right, so that's every day.
Little pieces, you know, like, but we have to do our part.
That's it. We're on a task.
Well, thank you for doing your part today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Always a pleasure learning with you, Jonathan.
My pleasure.
Have a good Seda. Steve, have a wonderful Seda.
Have a great holiday.
Pesach, and we next year, right?
Exactly. Next year we should be, God willing, we'll be together in Jerusalem.
Yes. Amen.
Okay.
Amen.
All right.
Thanks again, Jonathan.
Okay. Have a great week, guys. All the best. Happy holidays.